This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to the Understanding Cancer Podcast, a series of key conversations that bring together all you need to know about cancer, empowering you with information and knowledge. This 10 podcast series is brought to you by Discovery. My name is Sonia Booth. Each week we chat to some of the country's foremost experts in the fields of health and wellness for cancer prevention, as well as in cancer treatment. We are bringing you fascinating insights relevant to every person out there. In our 7th episode, we are focusing on emotional support through the cancer journey. Today I'm in conversation with Norma Moller, a counseling psychologist. She is also a breast cancer survivor, and she's been in remission for 7 years. Norma joins us via Skype from Cape Town. We also have Nonhlanhla Dube with us in studio. Nonhlanhla is a clinical health specialist with the Cancer Association of South Africa. She is also a professional nurse and oncology educator. Ladies, welcome.
Thank you, Sonia.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with the emotional support at diagnosis. Everyone reacts differently. Can you give us examples of some of these experiences or moments?
You're correct in saying that it's very different, and I think it's probably an important thing to respect that people do have different experiences. It's quite important to listen as well and to not accept that everyone is having maybe the same type of experience, but to hear what people are going through. There are probably themes, though. I'm sure for many people it's that old cliche of we tend to know that cancer can happen to anybody, but we still don't believe it will happen to us. So initially, to hear that you have cancer is particularly bad news, and it's very shocking and traumatic. So all the things that typically happen when you're exposed or presented with something that's traumatic in any other situation typically can be your experience in hearing that you have cancer. So I suppose some examples: total shock and disbelief, panic even, because I think the reality is that cancer is a very traumatic experience to go through, but there's also a lot of additional hype and fear attached to the remote chance of even hearing that someone has cancer. So it's a particularly weighted topic. So a lot of people panic initially. You need some time just to come to terms with the whole idea that you have been diagnosed with cancer. So yes, different experiences, but I'm sure there's a lot to be said for many people do have a sense of complete disbelief or some form of fear, and if you panic and you're fearful, then there's a lot of emotion immediately as well. And so it's probably fair to say that if you're with somebody and you receive a diagnosis of cancer, it's ideal to be with somebody who can support you then, or spend a bit of time with you and help you through the initial moments as such.
No, is there anything you'd like to add onto that?
Yes, thank you. I'd like to add, I really concur with what she's just said, because, you know, the diagnosis of cancer to most people has got a connotation of, you know, death. Some people will just think of death. So there are a lot of psychological effects that happen, and they will differ with different people, as she has just mentioned. You know, other people will even have, you know, denying that, you know, it can't be me or it can't be cancer. You know, they go through a lot of stages. Like some will, after knowing that I'm diagnosed, a person can, you know, resort to isolating themselves because there's this fear, there's this disbelief, you know. So they go through a roller coaster of psychological effects, which, you know, we always have to reassure a person that this is normal because we are different. We respond to stimuli differently. If one thing can be told to us the same thing, I may respond differently. So, you know, it really calls for a lot of support because of this nature of some people really will even have anger. how can I, when a neighbor was doing this, how can I have, you know, cancer? You know, anger, it's also another thing that will also be a stumbling block towards helping the person effective, but which is important to understand. So the whole thing is, you know, a lot of psychological effects, which we need to understand that it's normal, and then come up with supportive measures in an appropriate manner. So yes, psychological effects are very common, and they come in different shapes, yeah, for different people.
And Norma, talking about individual needs and the varying support, emotional support that is needed for me as a female opposed to a male, as opposed to a child who's only 18 months old, because I mean, we do have very, very young cancer patients. You have different cancers. You're dealing with somebody with solid tumors versus blood cancers. So now, how do you even begin to give that emotional support that is individual to a specific person?
All right. My point of departure when I work with people in general, as a therapist, as a psychologist, is to say I won't start initiating any sort of formal support, irrespective of what the issue is, be it cancer, be it any other crisis or life challenge, without first listening to the person. So for me, that's always a point of departure. So if we say people, different people with diagnoses of cancer have different experiences, then for me, that's the reason especially to say, start out by listening and actually then knowing where to start a journey of supporting that person. So I suppose, aside from what I've just said, there are probably general, you know, differences that sometimes, if you say, think of a man or a male as opposed to a woman, and how that there are probably things that we could stereotypically expect, and sometimes we're correct to say that males might be more inclined to be brave or not show emotions as such, try to be brave or assume that that's the right thing to do, and that that equates to not showing emotions and just soldiering on. Where for women, I suppose socially it's more acceptable to be emotional and to show your emotions, which ironically probably helps you to be stronger as opposed to not showing your emotions. But I still think it's important to stop with the person you're working with and listen to them first and then work with what they need, and as opposed to as a support person assuming what they need. So yes, and then I think in terms of the difference between children or younger people and adults, one of the things that that we've already mentioned today is it's quite important to inform people and to tell them they're not alone, or that give them a sense of what they are experiencing as being normal. Because as soon as you're able to say, get a grasp of you're not the only person going through that, then you will have a sense as well that you're not the only one in the whole wild world, as opposed to the fact, the reality being that other people also share that experience. Because I do think that takes away a lot of the excessive distress even. It's just understanding, it's the whole principle of a support group even. It's just to know that there are other people who do actually share that experience, and that given what you're going through and being diagnosed with cancer, there are certain normal things to experience. So it does give you permission in a sense then to also know that it's okay to be emotional or to go through whatever you are going through. And perhaps for younger people, there's more work to be done in informing them than for somebody who perhaps is more mature and you understand a little bit, or by way of having more life experience, of the fact that experiences like this may be normal. But also, again, not to assume, to rather be with somebody in the moment, to listen to them and to give them what they need.
And I mean, what's more important is for us to realize that cancer counseling is not an event. It's a continuous process. And with
that
comes the psychological stages. I mean, 1 minute you're in denial. I mean, Nonhlanhla spoken about, you know, you even go through phases where you're like, why me? I'm angry. I'm bitter at the universe. There's the isolation, the emotions, and post-traumatic stress disorder.
Exactly.
I'd say that we also need to remember that it's not a case of, although on the one hand, it's very important to inform people. You know, if you were able to understand that in yourself you can expect certain things, you can expect to go through certain emotional experiences, and somebody prepares you as much as that's reasonable to be able to do, then you know to some degree what to expect. Because I think the big thing about cancer and managing it is that it's a very uncertain experience. There's a lot there's a big component of it in my own experience. It was the uncertainty is the most difficult part to manage in many ways. So to inform people and at least give them a sense of what to experience or what to expect at least, I think that's empowering. So you can tell people that, you know, it's normal. It's like any loss that you need to deal with. It's a process. You should go through it. It's healthy to go through it. You can't bypass it. And in going through it, there's certain things that you should experience or expect to experience. But having said that, also identify that it's not a clearly delineated experience that will be the same for everybody. And then if we look at the phases of loss and dealing with loss, a lot of people vacillate and experience them at different times, or some are shorter and others experience that the same thing in a more extended way. And sometimes we jump between phases. It's actually just important, I think, to always know that we're different. Everyone's story is a very different and personal story. So yes, we need to prepare people and then also allow them to also trust their own experience and to know that within a certain frame of what to expect, you don't necessarily have to be like everybody else. Because I think it's extremely important as well when you help people to prepare them to manage the whole the treatment process, for instance, is to tell them what to expect. But also it's really important to know that your story doesn't have to be everybody's story. Because in looking at what people go through in cancer, that the most traumatic stories are often the ones that are sad stories. And unfortunately, that's what people tend to think of first, or when we're diagnosed with cancer, we think we'll be one of those bad stories. Or we read on the internet and we get to see case studies and things, and it seems to be that it's quite easy to get a worst case scenario. And it's very important, I think, to give people a fair understanding that it doesn't have to be your story. There are many, many, many positive stories, and actually, I'd go as far as even saying, because that's my experience, that cancer can actually be a gift. It can bring things into your life that, even though you never want to go through the experience again, you wouldn't want to lose. I think you need to give people a fair chance to see that type of, or have those types of expectations.
Norma, that is profound insight from your personal experience with breast cancer. Nonhlanhla, your view on really allowing a patient to express their personal reaction to cancer, what would that be?
As a person is diagnosed with cancer, and for example, you're imagining myself being a clinical setting where the patients are going to be treated, knowing that it's a long-term process that they'll be undergoing. So that initial assessing of the patient, as in that is the assessment which will include knowing where they come from, who they are, you know, their families and all that. That sometimes it becomes a very tedious process, but it's necessary to spend quality time and assessing the patient, asking all those relevant questions that could be on their initial contact or treatment process. And that helps us to be able to have a good patient-centered approach, because by so doing, you'll be able to talk to this person, or already you'll be able to understand them, even their social, their psychological situation, even their social situation, because that assessment, I'm seeing it as being very vital at the beginning, because, you know, an individual's aspects, they don't manifest themselves in isolation. But if you understand a person in totality, then it also helps us to be able to meet their needs, their psychological needs, in a very well thought out manner.
Nonhlanhla, what is the role of the multidisciplinary clinical team in as far as supporting the individual in the early stages?
When we have assessed them already, we will have identified the needs of this particular person. And either because the interdisciplinary team is important to try and meet the needs of the person in totality, so that there isn't anything that is left out. So the interdisciplinary team members, for example, will involve be it the social worker if there are any social problems, psychologist, be it the doctor, the chemotherapist or radiotherapist that will be treating the patient. It could also be a surgeon, because if maybe the cancer that the person has experienced does maybe need some or has had surgical interventions, so that will be important. The list goes on. For example, it can even be a child who has been diagnosed with cancer. So the teacher could be a very important part of that team. The nurses that are going to be maybe 24 hours with the patient are very, very important. So within this team, we always advocate that the patient must be at the center of the team. So the patient, that's where the question of patient-centeredness being very important, because we might all have our expertise about how to go about with the cancer, but now this person needs to be informed so that at the end of it all, he or she understands as well what she or is about to go through, much as that type of that time of education, as we have just said, it may not be a once-off event but a continued process. So the importance of the interdisciplinary team is to ensure that we meet the needs of the individual in totality at whatever time when the person needs to be attended to about whatever needs that may be identified.
I'm glad that you actually just covered oncology care and the importance and the role thereof. Norma, patients report that specialists can be too harsh, that they don't make time for them. And, you know, sometimes patients fear asking questions because they just feel perhaps they're not going to be attended to, or their questions won't be answered in a manner that will satisfy them in a way.
I've got quite strong feelings, and I think I agree completely with what Francis said just now, and in answering your question now, my sense is that, and it comes from my own experience when I did my treatment 7 years ago, and from speaking to people who are my clients and have to work with specialists, I think they are incredibly amazing people in oncology and in cancer support, because you can imagine that people who do any type of work like this are called probably to do it, and it's not an easy journey to work with so many people who often are in such difficult situations. So we take our hats off in general to the people who are offering this support and the multidisciplinary support as well. And having said that, I think there are things that are probably just human and normal that happen. And I think in my own experience, I am one of my biggest challenges, and that's one of the things that probably literally hurt me the most in my own treatment, was a sense that I didn't feel as though the doctor I had, even though it was a very competent person, I think we had differences, and I felt at times that perhaps part of the problem, although it obviously relates, it's about a relationship and it comes from both sides, but I think part of it sometimes must mean as well that professionals, and I can include myself then in that, if I see myself in my therapist role, we tend to sometimes, there's always a risk that you can become too almost blasé about people, especially because it's also a way of protecting yourself when you're exposed to many patients who are hurting and who have, and you need to just produce, and it's a job that you do. So sometimes I think there's a risk that doctors or any other specialists, and I'm sure they're aware of it and they have to manage it, but that they can become a little bit it's slightly impersonal. And as I said, maybe it's because they protect themselves in doing that. So sometimes patients, I'm sure, are affected by that. And then aside from that, I think patients generally, in the culture of thinking that a doctor is always the final word, so to speak. You have to listen. The doctor is the person who knows best. And we get a sense, I think, that in our culture, maybe we don't always challenge a doctor. And mostly, I suppose, that's a healthy way of thinking about things. But I do also think there's room to say that if you don't get along with a professional, it's not so much, it's not wrong to look for somebody whose bedside manner you do appreciate. I think we need to encourage people who are going through cancer and cancer treatment to see that in dealing, I think this is just generally my attitude as well, in coming through this in a well way and in a good way and in conquering it as such, you need to take ownership of your journey. And in part of that, it's very important to also give yourself permission to even challenge in a fair way the people who are supporting you. And if you feel as if you are at the mercy of a system that's not working for you, then it's okay to question it. It's also okay to perhaps find a second opinion sometimes. And I think we should encourage people to do that because it's very empowering to get a sense of being able to take ownership of where you're headed with your journey. So I'm not sure if that's, if you are comfortable with what I mean to say in that, but it's for me an important part of helping people to actually make sure that whoever is supporting them is giving them the support they need.
Absolutely. So now, I mean, there's no doubt that chemo causes side effects. I mean, the hair falls out. There's weight gain, weight loss. You're missing work. And there's also a possibility that you're not able physically and you're now even absent away from your kids, whether you're in hospital or you locked away in your bedroom because you don't want them to see you in that state. So all this fear that comes about, you know, that must wreak havoc on your emotional and mental well-being, right?
I can again speak from my personal experience. I think you're really right. There's a lot, I think, for people who start a journey of needing to go through cancer treatment. One of the things that's probably worthwhile remembering or being aware of is that a lot of the distress in managing cancer actually relates to the treatment. We get ill because we are having chemotherapy. And I think it helps to remember that even though you are extremely ill sometimes and it varies, different people react differently to the treatment. And it's not pleasant, definitely. I'm not denying that at all. But it helps to remember that it's not the cancer at that point doing that. It's the treatment and therefore it will pass. So that's one thing too, I think, that does help, because we go into treatment and we're so afraid because we actually have a sense that we just won't come out of it. And in my mind, it starts to make it manageable when you remember that the treatment, which is helping to get rid of the cancer, unfortunately also affects your normal cells and makes you ill, but that can pass. So that's one thing. And then I think again, in facing treatment, to be aware, you know, when I started out with my treatment, the doctors explained to me what the protocol was, meaning that I needed to get so many rounds of chemotherapy, and after this process, I'd be getting radiation treatment, and there was an initial operation at the beginning. And in my mind, when I'd been given that information, I was grateful for it because it helped me to say, I know now what to expect. And now I laugh about it because I actually planned accordingly. And then what happens is you go into treatment and you start with the first round of chemo, and you can only have your second treatment after, in my case, it's just 21 days, if your body is ready for it, which means blood tests and things have to be done. And immediately after the first 21 days, my body wasn't ready for the second treatment, which means the second treatment was delayed, which means there was a knock-on effect and the whole process became longer. And that didn't happen once, it happened a few times. So I think one of the things that people need to know is that there's a lot, you don't know what to expect. But if you already hear that people have different experiences and that there can be a change to that regime, the doctor says at the beginning will probably be your course, I think that would help, you know, because it's again something that helps you to know what to expect, if that's making sense. So and coming back to your question about fear often relates to the unknown, and for me, the thing about my hair falling out, it was a terrible thing to contemplate. It felt like, wow, that's the one thing I almost like about myself, and now my hair is going to fall out. And then when it did actually fall out, it was an extremely liberating experience, which was surprising. Maybe it was just because, okay, now it happened, and so I can carry on. But it wasn't as bad as I'd expected. So the fear, again, is always about not knowing what to expect. And maybe I'd really like to be able to say from my experience to all the women who fear what will happen when their hair falls out, that it's actually not that bad, or at least I'm an example of someone for whom it wasn't that bad. I wore hats, I wore scarves, I did all types of things that I would never have got to do if I hadn't had that experience. So that's just from my personal perspective.
And I know that one of the things that you were happy about is saving money on your shampoo and conditioner, right? Because I believe that you also got a henna tattoo on your head.
I did. I actually am very proud of that. It was quite a moment to put a picture on this bald head. And, yeah, it obviously doesn't last forever because it's a henna tattoo, but it was something and it was a bit of a statement. And I got to do something that I would never have done or contemplated having the opportunity to do. So I suppose sometimes it's just about also saying, you know what, I'm going through this. I wouldn't choose to. I don't want to have chemotherapy. I don't want to. But now that I'm in it, what can I do? Or how can I make it not only just bearable, but, you know, how there's something for me in treatment in cancer about taking ownership of the process. I've already said that. It's just to say that you're a survivor or to just say I'm getting through that is so... It's fine. It's cool to be a survivor as well. But to actually say, well, how am I going to manage this? How am I really going to take charge of it in a sense? It's a difficult thing to put into words, but there's a capacity in us all to decide to claim the process in a way. You can't change it. You have to go through it. And so it's about deciding how you go through it. And I think there are definitely things that you can do to go through it in a way that's really empowering despite the illness. And I say that with respect because I realize it's not perhaps an easy thing to actually implement.
Absolutely. Nonhlanhla, the lack of psychological and financial support can negatively affect the entire healing process, right?
Exactly. Definitely. That can really affect the entire process negatively because the person will have, you know, worries and concerns about what is the next step. Psychologically, it helps you a lot if you are financially well prepared for whatever eventuality that can come in. You know, also just as she was talking about the importance of the individual with cancer taking charge of the process, you know, that is very, very key. But what helps one to be able to take charge of that process. Earlier on, we talked about, you know, the rights, you know, when you are informed about your disease and if you feel uncomfortable. I'm just coming back to this because trust is very, very important in terms of the team that is helping you. And also another aspect that I would just like to bring in at this stage, which helps a person, be it financial problems or social problems, your spirituality also comes in being very key in terms of helping you to go through the process. Of course, there are a lot of whatever ways that we believe in, but that's why there must be that interaction and advice, because I may not have some spiritual beliefs that may be detrimental to my care. So when bringing in some of the factors that may affect a person negatively, if you've got this foundation of support that has been built, you know, in trust, in open communication, in viewing you as an important person. For example, you are talking about finances. That's why when we talk of the team, for example, social workers become a very important aspect, because let's say a person has been diagnosed and this person is a breadwinner. Somewhere, somehow, the financial issues will come in, kick in as a problem. Maybe also they may even have difficulty in taking time off work, which will also, you know, impact on their financial situation. But at the same time, if they cannot follow the prescribed or the ideal process that has been prescribed for their ill health, then there will be that will be a problem. So the kind of social workers or any relevant referral will be ideal to help and support this person. You know, so it also brings us to not just having the team, but having the team to ensure that any needs are met for this particular person. That's why, for example, you know, we live in South Africa, where there is this process now of coming up with the NHI National Health Insurance, you know, where we are calling really that if only the government can do this so that there are no people that are disadvantaged, that cannot maybe afford finances when they are having a life-threatening illness. So these are all the issues that needs to be taken in consideration of, because even our preparedness in terms of medical aids or in terms of finances when such a disease like a cancer come about, we may not be the same. So that's why we have to think broadly and really make sure that everybody has got a fair access to treatment as much as possible.
And then another worry is that the patient is not the only person that's affected, the entire family unit. I mean, there can be disruptions where you needing to be rushed to the emergency room in the middle of the night or even during the day when, you know, there's hard, most family members, some of them are at work or some are at school. But then now, and then some other family members are worried, what should we feed you? Are we taking care of you in the right manner? Are we giving you the right emotional support? What can families do, you know, to adequately support? Obviously, it can never be enough because, you know, different people, some people want their space.
Yes.
And they want to shut themselves in their bedroom, as I've said earlier. And some people just really need for somebody to constantly knock on the door to check, are you okay? So what do you do as a family member?
The role of the family is very, very important. You know, like we would say, it's a family, or a significant other, because a person that is significant to an individual is their family. The question of being patient-centered being very important there, not being prescriptive as who is the family or not. So, you know, the family or significant other, they are so important because if it's an adult, that could be a spouse. And we know, even us when we were trained, we knew that if an individual in a family is sick or is ill, the other family members will also be ill. So that's why we cannot not involve the family within the conversation and within the need of helping this family. The question of assessing properly the patient and their social situation comes in here, because if I'm a family member and maybe I'm a mother, I could be having children that are looking up to me in terms of every day, because there are roles that we play as family members. So now, to bring in the family even early in the early stages of this disease and find out about their fears, find out about their concerns, what needs to be done for them in terms of meeting their needs, whereby you bring in that interdisciplinary team to help with the person. So family is very, very crucial, because cancer can even affect your intimate intimate relationships, depending on where the cancer is. For example, us as women, our breasts are very, very important. And in our intimacy, the breasts are very important. And breast cancer, when you are diagnosed with breast cancer, already some people can even think that, my God, my womanhood is going. What is going to happen with my partner? So that's where, at early in the disease process, the question of also nurturing that support or that relation, helping the people to come together. Hence, I was saying earlier on, the, you know, person-centered care being important, and also helping them to alleviate any fears that they are having and have interventions that will also bring the family together. And, you know, also talking about the importance of the family, if a child, for example, has been diagnosed, there's going to be, you know, children, if they are weaned from their families, obviously, they may not be able to cope well with the treatment. So the psychological preparedness and understanding that, you know, my family is here, my children are well taken off, and I'm not going to lose out maybe in school, it makes a person to be psychologically ready and be able to go through the treatment process, because as we know, treatments are very, very harsh. So imagine if physically you are not well, psychologically you are going to be affected. And if psychologically you are worried about a lot of things, about your relationships, about your family, so you are bound not to be able to cope with the treatment. So family is very, very important. Whatever, whether you are single parent, because also there are even single parents who've got children. So imagine when they've got cancer. So all this, making sure that such aspects are taken care of, it helps the patient to go through the treatment journey in a reasonable manner, knowing that all their significant people are taken care of. And their significant people are also there to support them, you know, during the treatment process, be it taking them to the chemo or taking them for radiation, just sitting there, being there, holding their hands, it's very, very essential. So the family, involving the family according to the patient's needs, it's very, very crucial in the whole process.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Norma, now in the case where an adult is diagnosed, how can social workers liaise with the school, for example, to give support to their child?
The system probably mostly introduces, that was in my experience, the role of the social worker. So in my experience, it was the doctors almost direct you or involve the social workers. So I would expect that that person's role is to get to know the people, the patient, him or herself, and understand their need, because to be able to just go into a school situation and work with children, they're all different. They come from different contexts. I think that social worker has an extremely valuable role to play, but it's a facilitation role. So it probably, in my mind, starts with actually assessing that specific family's needs and, again, listening and helping them to actually be prepared in terms of what to expect. My sense, if you speak of children, is that a lot of times children are fine as long as they, even if there's a problem, even if there's illness and they're aware that there's illness and that mommy or daddy is being treated and needs to go to hospital, those children will be relatively okay if they also understand that there is a plan and that there's a reason and that they're quite secure in that the adults around them seem to be okay. Mm-hmm. So we actually end up projecting whatever our emotions are onto our children and creating either certainty or uncertainty in their minds. So to include them in an age-appropriate manner so that you're honest with them and they do know, children won't be afraid of illness if they know that illness is part of life and we need to deal with it in certain ways. It's actually a life lesson. It's an honest way of equipping them for life. So I wouldn't say it's appropriate to hide them from the process, but to include them in an age-appropriate way, which is safe and which is protected for them. And so I'm sure the social worker is somebody who's very equipped to help in that way.
And Nonhlanhla, as a friend, how do I support my friends when their child is diagnosed?
So as a friend, you know, friendship, most of the time we end up being family with the friends, you know, your friends become the most best sister that you can talk to. So even then, it's about being there for your friend. It's about finding out, what can I do for you? How can I help you during this time? Being there to make sure that the process is made as easy as much as possible. So friendships really play a very, very important role as well. As I say, that they can just also become as good as family. But also maybe just to come in, just to add, you know, on the support for the children as well. You know, for example, you know, at the Cancer Association, there are these TLC homes where they provide tender loving care, though the actual TLC coming from the fact that it's acknowledged that it's tough living with cancer. So there, you know, there will be children's play, especially because cancer centers are very few. They're not all over South Africa. So you find that the people that are diagnosed coming from rural or semi-rural areas where there's no cancer treatment. So these care homes and these TLC homes are there to help during that process of going for chemo or for radiation on a daily basis. So the mothers will also be accommodated where the children are getting their treatments. And the friends can also come in and visit or maybe take the children to school or whatever. So places like the Cancer Association, they do help with such facilities to make sure that the support is maximized as much as possible, as the social workers are also available. And of course, also it brings in the important element of home-based care, because certain people at home, they may be there not having proper support at home. So in our ensuring that the care is continued properly, we always advocate for home-based care where somebody can go into the home setting and support, because not everybody is admitted continuously. Other people are being discharged, they are at home during the treatment, and there could be a need for support. So that community-based care also becomes important, be it it's a volunteer, whether it's a friend or it's the family, but the family, it's very important to note that they also need support during that time when their loved one is having treatment of cancer, which takes a long time most of the time.
And now let's look at a scenario where you are faced with a young couple and one of the partners has been through cancer treatment, and then now the conversation around infertility. How do you go about supporting such a couple? I mean, they're young, they have plans to start a family, but now there's a possibility that they actually might not be able to conceive.
You know, it's very important. That's why we keep on saying counseling, information sharing, it's not an event. It has to be a continuous thing. You know, in such a scenario, I think the oncologist that has diagnosed or that will be treating this person becomes very key initially to share the information, because the question of infertility depends on where the cancer is and also depends on the type of treatment that the person is going to get and or the type of chemotherapy that the person is going to get. So for me, it's very key at the beginning for the doctor to tell the person about their diagnosis and about the treatment and the possible effects of the treatment, so that people can make a well-informed decision at that stage, because we always say early treatment is key. But now that will be an opportunity of discussing alternatives if there is potential for infertility after the chemo, after the cancer and the chemo or the radiotherapy. So that's when a person will have to be informed about alternatives that are available, because there are alternatives, you know, of maybe fostering or even adoption. But remember, it is a process, and not everybody will react very well. That is the time that calls for really support on a continuous basis, be it therapeutic, with social workers or whatever. But it's a very sensitive topic which needs really proper time. Even if the person has got questions, because as I keep on saying that it's not an event, they might have been informed, but there must be openness to say, should you have any questions at any stage, and then please don't hesitate. And that in presence of the team, ensuring that you are supported psychologically and what could be your alternatives becomes very, very critical with such sensitive potential results of infertility and not being able to have children. And the importance of ensuring that the partner is also supported, so that they can support their significant person that has been affected and having the potential problems of having infertility.
Let's look at another form of equally important support. Is it always important to talk about the possibility of palliative care early on in a person's cancer journey?
Very, very important. You know, the World Health Organization, when it defines palliative care, they do mention that the role of palliative care is there even early in the disease process. In other words, at diagnosis, palliative care measures must be introduced. And then
if and when the disease is not controlled, or the curative measures have been mainly controlled the disease, then palliative care takes the major role. So in other words, what palliative care involves, it involves your meeting the physical needs, meeting the psychological needs, meeting every other needs that the person might have. So all what we are talking about, for example, advocating for interdisciplinary measures or advocating for proper pain control, those are aspects of palliative care. Sometimes you may not say now we're doing palliative care, but the approach has to build in the palliative care measures, because palliative care stands for quality care. So yes, it is appropriate to ensure that palliative care is introduced early in the disease process, like we've been discussing. And if the disease is not maybe being controlled as just desired, or maybe the person is in an advanced stage, then the palliative care measures become more and more. Because one of the very important aspects of palliative care, it's about proper pain control. You know, as when we study about pain, you learn that pain is a total pain. It's not only physical. You know, for example, if I may just bring this in, you know, I grew up in the nursing profession, more working in oncology, I had this very passionate radiotherapist who would always say that she learned that, you know, if a person has got no roof over their head, their pain is going to be worse. You know, she was just relating that to in early days, you know, when people, if they didn't pay their bonds or their rent or whatever, their houses will be taken away from them, because the person, like we're talking about, the social problems. So she had this person, this male, who had severe pain, and he was the breadwinner, and his house was to be confiscated back, and he was worried about his family. But this information was never identified early in the process. He was on such good pain control medications, but his pain was not controlled. Eventually, after she interviewed, because this doctor was very passionate, sometimes he would come in for ward rounds, wouldn't ask you the nurse or this junior doctor. He would just go and hold the patient's hand and ask, how are you feeling? And she wanted to know more what was happening, only to find that the patient was worried about the house and the rents and all that was not being sorted out. And she made efforts that those problems were sorted out of the patient. After a day or two, the pain was controlled with the same measures that were done previously. She even said, I have learned that a roof over your head can control your pain. So in other words, it's about saying, identifying the problems in totality and meeting them in a comprehensive manner, not in isolation, to make sure that the patient is helped comprehensively.
I love that you speak about a holistic approach, because exactly. Discovery has holistic programs, yes, such as the Advanced Illness Benefit, right?
Yes.
So patients can make use of that, because those avenues are available to them.
That's wonderful, you know, to have such prescribed benefits for the patients, because you cannot help a patient with cancer without such. So it's commendable to have discover having that holistic or comprehensive approach to helping the person according to the needs that they have in totality, which actually even must include the what I was talking about, that follow-up care even in the home setting. That is very wonderful for the patients. And it's good to create that awareness, because sometimes the patients, they don't even know what they're entitled to. So that's why it becomes essential to inform them as much as possible about what they are entitled to as they're having this. Because when you're sick, sometimes you don't even know what is available there for out there for you.
Something that can't be avoided is the Advance Directive. What is the importance of that?
Sure. The Advance Directive becomes very, very important. That's one of the things that we advocate for in terms of planning, you know,
for your health and how to be cared for. You know, sometimes we find that people, we tend to plan or think about how to care for a person only when they are ill. Whilst it is important to make those plans when you can still make your own decisions, when we are still well, to say, when I get ill, this is the type of care that I would like to have. So to have, you know, advice and information sharing about advanced directives about when it happens that I get ill, it's very, very important, because when we are no longer able to make decisions for yourself, the family may also find a hard time to make the most appropriate decision for you, because families are also having individuals that may have their own ways of seeing things. But if there is an advance directive that has been put down, and I also believe that for any individual to be able to put down and say, this is what I would like to be contained in this advance directive, they also have to be well advised, so that I don't make expectations or make suggestions that are contrary to what is available or what is legally out there. So the importance of making advance directives, it cannot be, you know, overemphasized, that it has to be done, because at the end it will support you, your care, the kind of care that you would like when a certain stage of your inability to care for yourself comes, and also it will be able to support the family to make decisions about what needs to be in place for you during that particular stage.
Norma, what other resources can you recommend that are out there, you know, whether it's support programs, for example, that people can access?
Mm. There's so many facets or aspects that we can use or utilize, and it's about informing people and reminding them, because remember, when you're busy with cancer treatment or facing the prospect of treatment, there's so much emotion, and I think there's so much almost inability to be objective. So for us as professionals who support people, I think it's quite important to inform them and to remind them of the various aspects. And for a patient as well, one of the things I would encourage people to do is to say, it's a time in your life when you should use all the resources that you have available to you. And one of your resources is your family and even the friends and people you can support that can support you. We equip other people to support us when we tell them what we need. You know, so people around the patient, the loved ones, they're very fearful. They feel perhaps even more out of control, because if you're the patient, you still have a sense of you're the one going through this. And even though that's terrible, it's actually in some ways possibly a more empowered position than to be the spouse or the loved one who doesn't actually have any control or isn't in it even as much as you are. So in informing people and telling them what you need, you actually make it possible for people to be more empowered and to know what you need, and you also get what you need, so to speak. I mean, just to continue with what you've just asked me, I think the support and the resources lie in taking care of yourself, I suppose, while you're going through treatment in as best way you can. So if that means, like you were saying just now, that there are other concerns and other worries that cause you to not be able to manage pain, and if, as we as professionals are able to do something about the other concerns, like in your example just now about having a roof over your head, then we need to be aware enough so that we can actually look at those aspects. And then for a patient to know that they have opportunities or access to ways of dealing with those other problems, because as you've just said in your example, that would help them to actually get on with healing or feeling better and feeling less pain. So in keeping with managing yourself and looking after yourself, I think to deal with pain sometimes means things like learning how to rest, learning how to take time out from, how to accept that this is a time in your life when you're going through treatment where perhaps you can't do all your normal things, and to acknowledge and accept that makes it actually easier to go through it. Perhaps to accept and to allow other people into your life and to use them as a resource to cope, because remember, a lot of us, we don't like being vulnerable, or we don't want to depend on others, and it's quite challenging to be able to do that. And the sooner you can do that and see it as actually a way of utilizing a strength, not so much as being weak, the better you're able to cope. I was extremely intent on being healthy. And I was very inspired to say, well, how could I do? I couldn't have perhaps a total outcome of whether I ever have cancer recurring or not, because I'm in remission. I still don't know what the future holds, but I can, in a sense, fight it in my way by being quite healthy or doing certain things that are possible. And I think that what I'm trying to say is there are people and there are things that you can do in your life that are empowering, given that there are times when we don't feel all energized or too weak to do it, but there are other times where it's possibly something that you have access to or someone you can speak to. And another resource is definitely to speak to other people who have gone ahead of you, and not to read too many negative stories, but to actually also know that there are extremely wonderful positive stories of success and healing. So I think those are the types of things that you need to be aware of that you could expose yourself to in terms of using your resources.
Nhlanhla, would you like to add anything to that?
Very, very important what she has just said, you know, of that ability, if you are diagnosed, to make sure that you don't always be the one that is strong, but use other people as resources. And as earlier on, as I've also talked about the importance of your spirituality, what you believe in. You know, we've seen that allowing the spirituality of a person to play a very important part during their illness, it becomes a very important resource for a person to go through the process. And also something that I would like to also mention is that, you know, there's so much information out there, but not all that information may be speaking to one's individual situation, because, you know, we find that people will Google this and that and that, you
yes.
know, and think that they've got all the answers, or maybe ask questions, or that information overload confuses the hell out of a person, you know. So it's very important to have trust and have people that, even if you do get some information, but don't take it at face value that this is what is going to affect me, but find out from the people. That's why the team must be accessible and must be approachable and be available to help, you know, allay whatever fears that an individual might have.
Ladies, thank you for sharing key insights from your professional and personal experiences today. I am sure our listeners are far more sensitized to what supporting those affected by cancer really means. I know I am.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
We've been talking all about emotional support through the cancer journey. To listen to all the episodes in our 10 podcast series, go to discovery.co.za/corporate/podcasts. In our next episode, we will explore cancer survivorship. With me in studio will be a doctor focused on survivorship care, a unique focus in the South African medical world. And we will also hear from a survivor of recurrent cancer. I think she's one of the most dynamic and inspiring people out there. All brought to you by Discovery.
This is CliffCentral.com.